The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're looking at the science of psychopathy. We'll talk about social science research that tries to identify psychopathic traits, neuroimaging that's helping us understand the physical symptoms of psychopathy, and behavioral therapies hoping to treat it. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. With me is Dr. Kent Keel, a neuroscientist who specializes in the use of clinical brain imaging techniques to understand major mental illnesses, criminal psychopathy, psychotic disorders, traumatic brain injury, substance abuse, and paraphilias. He designed a one-of-a-kind mind-mobile MRI system to conduct research and treatment studies with inmate populations, and his laboratory has collected brain imaging data from over 3,000 offenders at 8 different facilities, which is the world's largest forensic neuroscience repository. He also lectures to state and federal judges, lawyers, probation officers, correctional officials, academic audiences, and the public about the intersection of neuroscience and the law, and the use and misuse of neuroscience in the courtroom. He's here today to discuss his new book, The Psychopath Whisperer, The Science of Those Without Conscience. Kent, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
There seems to be a combination of skills needed to do the work you do, especially the work you called out in this book, training in neuroscience to get, analyze, and interpret brain scans, and a psychologist's training to run the interviews with the inmates. That part in itself seems like a whole challenge.
It definitely takes, you know, I've been fortunate to have a lot of good collaborators and good mentors to help with the training in these different disciplines, as you've said, because it does, you know, cover everything from basic, even, you know, test construction. How do you assess psychopathic traits reliably and validly? And then how do you go about implementing that? How do you go about, you know, recruiting and working with forensic populations? And then, of course, the MRI side of things, you know, runs the gamut from understanding the physics to designing the equipment to collecting the data to designing studies. And then, of course, there's people who spend their entire careers analyzing data. And so it definitely is what we would refer to as an interdisciplinary field. And I've been very fortunate to have had good mentors in each of those different fields.
We are going to dive into the neuroscience in pretty soon, but I do want to talk a little bit about some of the psychiatric skills needed for this. There are several times in the books where you have to recognize you're being manipulated or lied to by one of the inmates you're studying. How much training did you have before going into the prison system to conduct these interviews?
So there wasn't a lot of formal training that happened. My graduate school experience was kind of sink or swim. I was just kind of thrown into the mix and was told, you know, the inmates are down that door, go ahead and start, you know, working with them. Of course, I had done a lot of reading about different issues, and certainly always Hollywood's popular, you know, with stories and movies about individuals in prison manipulating others, et cetera. But it really did take a bit of a open mind to try to recognize when if there were stressful things coming up or if I was being played or et cetera. And once you kind of let that paranoia creep into consciousness to make sure that you are making sure that you're not being manipulated, it's not an environment that I've had much trouble with.
And on top of that, of course, you're working every day in a prison with a group of people that are not necessarily the kinds of people most of us would want to work with every day. So did you find that challenging?
Certainly there's been, I mean, I find individual psychopathy fascinating clinically to work with. And so I've always been, you know, just really interested in working with them. But differentiate that from, I probably we don't want to go have beers with them if they're on the outside, for example. So I tend to really enjoy the clinical side of working with them, studying, understanding, and I just find it really fascinating, you know, their personality, the traits, the lack of empathy, the emotional side of things, et cetera, and then the things that they've done. But certainly like anybody who works with, you know, this population, either from a law enforcement angle all the way up and through, you know, the correctional officials, there are certainly some days that can be more stressful than others, and I've had my share of those as well. Sometimes people tell you things that are so bad, it's just really difficult to deal with. So they definitely have to develop a good, healthy set of coping skills if you're working with people like this. But generally, overall, I find it, you know, particularly just clinically fascinating to study and work with them.
I want to talk a little bit about how psychopathy is identified, because I think this is really fascinating as well. Can you talk a little bit about the Hare Psychopathy Checklist Revised?
Yeah, so for several hundred years, clinicians would talk about individuals that they referred to as having psychopathic traits, and there were a number of early meetings as early as 1908 where people were talking about this cluster of symptoms that we now call psychopathy. But it wasn't really until 1980s, early 90s, that there was a really significant effort devoted to coming up with very clear criterion and a very clear scale for assessing those criterion and setting up all of those procedures. And that's what's encompassed in what we refer to as the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, named after Robert Hare, who was the main driving force behind it. So it's 20 items. There are items like lack of empathy, guilt and remorse, glibness, superficial charm, impulsivity, early developmental trajectory. So kids who have high scoring on psychopathy usually have started before the age of 12 with antisocial behavior, drug use, etc. It persists through adolescence in terms of severe adolescent delinquency and continues as an adult in terms of a wide variety of different types of antisocial behavior, as an adult. And so there's these 20 items, and an individual is scored on a three-point scale. 0, this item does not apply to you at all. A 1, the item applies to you somewhat. Or 2, the item definitely applies to you in all aspects. And then you get a score that range then from 0 to 40. 40 is the perfect score, we call it. And the gives you a nice metric for assessing the level of psychopathy in each individual. The average male, for example, will score about 4 out of 40. The average prisoner or forensic participant will score about 20 out of 40, or about halfway up the scale. And then we reserve the label psychopath or having psychopathy for those that are over 30, so in the top kind of 10, 15, 20 percentile, depending on the prison that you're in, have that correct criterion. So it's really hard to reach these criterion. It's only about 1 in 150 men in the world will meet those the high levels of the traits, the so-called diagnosis of psychopathy. But now that we have this instrument, it's not like I just hand you a self-report scale and say, here, tell me if you're a psychopath or not. You actually have to interview them for several hours and review all of the collateral information about them. You have to read all the social worker reports and crime histories and police reports and, employment details and all sorts of all aspects of their life. And it really is that whole picture that you're looking for. In order to, for example, have lack of empathy, it needs to be at home, at work, at school, with family and friends. It needs to be a trait. It needs to be something that you see in all these different domains. And so when you have somebody that then scores high in all of those traits, that's what we refer to as someone who has psychopathy. So it definitely takes a lot of bit of effort and training and some skills to score the criterion correctly.
So just so that we're clear and all the listeners understand, this isn't necessarily just scoring them on a crime or a series of crimes that they've committed. This actually looks at their entire life and scores them on almost personality traits.
Yeah, psychopathy is a personality disorder by definition, and so you do have to make sure you have a focus on not being persuaded by just one bad thing that they've done, and so you have to be looking at the entire life history of the individual, their entire adult life in particular, to determine if they have the presence of those traits in different domains. So in the book, for example, I score 2 presidential assassins in the United States, and one of them, they both did singularly terrible crimes, and one scores very high in psychopathy and the other doesn't. And so the single crime, even a presidential assassination, doesn't going to give you a label of psychopathy. You have to look in much more detail. So that's something that is often very carefully taught when we do training programs where we teach clinicians how to make and do the assessments of psychopathy.
And I'm assuming these assessments aren't entirely built on the interview with the inmate. They're probably also built on details of the cases, details of their lives, interviews with friends or relatives potentially?
Yes, absolutely. You have to have the collateral information, those other sources of information, in order to score the traits. So you can't score the instrument from just an interview alone, and that's because often one of the traits of psychopathy is pathological lying and manipulation. And so they can make up stories, make themselves sound good, etc., but you have to be able to verify and check the background in order to get the correct information. So the interview is just one piece of it, and what you're often looking for is a disconnection between what they say in the interview and what's in their files. And so sometimes it's also very useful to ask them, what does your file say? What does your neighbors say? What did your family members say? Oh, they'll tell you a different story, they might say, but they're not really that important, and they'll move on to the next thing. So it's definitely a two-part process, and you really do want to have both parts, when you're doing the assessment.
I'm curious. It seems like we've had the idea of psychopathy for quite a while. You talk in your book about, you know, ideas going back to antiquity about these types of people. But how long have we been trying to study psychopathy with any kind of rigor?
Well, I think that it really started in the late 70s, early 80s, with Dr. Robert Hare's work there at the University of British Columbia. And, you know, he was one of the earliest pioneers that came up with the common metric, the assessment. As a psychologist, I want to assess psychopathy over in, you know, in New Zealand, and I want to assess it in, you know, Europe, and I want to assess it in North America. We want to make sure we're talking about the same cluster, or the same group of individuals, same clusters of traits. And so by developing that instrument, he allowed the literature to grow because everybody was talking about the same individuals. Now, we might disagree academically about which traits are most important, about whether or not we should include them all or not, but when you use the same instrument to do the assessment and you do it with, you know, good reliability and good validity, good training, then we all are going to be talking about the same individuals. And so that's what has allowed the literature to expand, is because we have a common metric that can be used across the world, really, for assessing these traits. And it was, so I would say that you really lacked kind of, you know, scientific studies lacked a lot of rigor until they had that instrument. And so that would have been, you know, the early 90s would have been when it started. And if you look in the, I've published a figure that shows just the trajectory and the massive expansion of papers that have been published now since the introduction of that instrument, the Hare Psychopathy Checklist. So it really has just massively expanded and created a whole literature into itself. And so there's now thousands of studies that have been published from around the world using that instrument.
So how long have we suspected that psychopathy was related to something physically within the brain?
Well, I think that even the earliest clinicians recognized that something was different about individuals who have these traits. I mean, it's actually pretty psychologically palpable. That is, when you talk to them and you know that you're looking for this emotional disconnection kind of aspect of psychopathy, the lack of empathy, the lack of remorse, it's not that hard to recognize it. Now, figuring out where in the brain what might be different, that's been something that people speculated for a long time, mostly using studies of patients who might have some unfortunate brain damage from an injury or a stroke, and then looking to see what symptoms they have. So there's this group of patients who have damage to the orbital frontal cortex, the most famous of which is a man named Phineas Gage, who in the 1800s had an iron rod that was blasted up through the back of his behind his eye, and it destroyed part of the brain called the orbital frontal cortex, and that's the tissue right above the eyes. Well, Gage, after he had that accident, it's amazing first that he survived, but he had some personality changes, apparently became more impulsive, more garrulous, and no memory problems, no language problems, nothing else, but it just changed his personality to be more psychopathic than he was previously. And so that's how we would make inferences about what brain regions might be implicated in psychopathy, was to study patients who had personality changes following brain damage. So from that literature, which is now quite extensive, we have a lot of clues about where in the brain. But it's only been more recently that we've really started to study actual brains of individuals with psychopathy in the last probably 5-6 years.
So separating psychopaths from, let's say, ordinary criminals is more than just a scientific curiosity. This has actual predictive power, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's why the forensic system uses this instrument all the time. So it turns out that if you lack empathy, guilt, and remorse, and you've been like that most of your life from an early age, and you're impulsive and don't plan well, turns out when I release you from prison, you're more likely to come back than your roommate who scores low on those traits. So psychopathy has a lot of predictive power for understanding who's going to reoffend in the future and who's not. And in particular, it's very powerful for predicting violent recidivism. So the most costly, the most, you know, the thing that most of us are worried about is, you know, having some interpersonal violence or some death potentially occurring. And so individuals with psychopathy, those traits tend to predict that they will reoffend violently. Some studies have gone out upwards of 25 years now studying and showing that these traits predict violence. And so that's where and why it's used in risk assessment procedures. You know, if you're a judge or you're a parole board and you want to ask to do a risk evaluation of the client, the psychopathy checklist is usually used in order to say that this is one variable that they score low on or high on, and what are we going to do about it now that we have that information? So you try to develop a plan then that minimizes that risk. But that's where the forensic system, you know, typically includes psychopathy as in risk prediction and in risk mitigation.
I'm curious, how did the inmates you worked with and interviewed respond to your research?
My work originally started in Canada, out in Abbotsford area, in the lower mainland of BC. And there, the inmates were actually all very well versed with their psychopathy scores. It was done as part of their risk assessment. They routinely talked about that they were either a psychopath or not, or their roommate was a psychopath or not. And so they were there because they were also being asked to participate in a treatment program. And so they're being treated for their poor decision making, for, you know, criminal thinking, et cetera. And so they were very receptive to, you know, doing research associated with, you know, studying psychopathy, and, you know, getting their brain scanned at the time, and doing EEG studies, et cetera. So they were very receptive. But there were always the case that some inmates, they just don't like the term. It is a pejorative term. It does have a bad label associated with it, if you will. Some of them would prefer to use different terms so that they don't have that same connotation. But generally, most of them recognize that when you describe the traits to them or describe the things they've done in the past and why they might score high, they recognize that that's a problem that they've had. It doesn't necessarily mean they want to change it, but they do understand that people will score them high because of those behaviors once it's explained to them. But generally, the researchers, I mean, the inmates do enjoy doing the research. We study a lot of things in addition to psychopathy. We study substance abuse, and we study, stress and trauma histories and a variety of other things. And so they know that we're there to try to help develop better treatment so that they don't come back to prison. And so they generally tend to volunteer quite readily for doing the research studies.
Just quickly, it occurs to me that maybe we should define some key terms that people often confuse. I'm thinking psychopathy and sociopathy. What is the difference there?
Yeah, well, it's really just the evolution in terminology. So the term psychopathy was used, many, many, many years ago. That was the kind of original term used to describe this group of individuals. And then in the behaviorist era, when psychology argued that the main driving theory of the field was that you were born in a blank slate, and so when you came out of the womb, environmental forces were all that was relevant, and social forces could mold you to be pathological, sociopathy. So the social milieu that you grew up in, bad parenting, environment, etc., made you to be the person that you were, with 100% of it controlled by social forces. Well, psychopathy is agnostic to etiology, so we know that social forces play a role, we know that genetics play a role. And so we don't use the term sociopathy anymore in academic circles because it had that kind of etiology as the main kind of driving force behind it. But the symptoms of sociopathy were very similar, you know, to the symptoms that we use today to assess psychopathy. It was just that connotation. So we don't use the word sociopath anymore in academic discourse, although it's still used in popular discourse. It has a connotation of etiology that we know is not true. And so that's why psychopathy is the term that's used in academic writing.
You're tuned in to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm speaking to neuroscientist Dr. Kent Keel about the science of psychopathy and his book, The Psychopath Whisperer, The Science of Those Without Conscience. We'll be back with more Science for the People right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People with Rochelle Saunders. This week, I'm spending the hour learning about how science is working to refine the diagnosis and treatment of psychopathy. My guest is Kent Keel, author of The Psychopath Whisperer and creator of the mobile MRI system that's been used to collect imaging data for more than 3,000 criminal offenders. Okay, so let's dive into the neuroscience. Some of the first brain scans you did were EEG scans of inmates. Can you walk us through how those scans worked and what you discovered with them?
Sure. So the brain acts like it has millions of little batteries in it, and you can put sensors on someone's head and record those little batteries, and we call that the electroencephalogram, or, you know, EEG. And EEG can be recorded for, you know, just resting, eyes opened, eyes closed, and it can be analyzed by its frequency composition. Do you have more alpha or beta or different frequencies, you know, of brain activity that indicate, you know, something that might be abnormal or impaired? But then EEG can also be analyzed in terms of its its stimulus properties. So if I present stimuli to you, say emotional words versus neutral words, I can analyze how your brain responds to emotional words versus how your brain responds to emotional or to neutral words. And so we did a lot of those what are called event-related EEG studies, studying psychopathy and how their brains might be different in terms of how they processed information. And what we found was that it turns out psychopaths do process information differently. That is, they process emotional stimuli differently. They process things even as simple as abstract words. So the word very, the word justice, those types of words usually engender a very different process in non-psychopathic individuals, and psychopaths appear to have problems processing those abstract concepts. And then we did a whole series of studies looking at kind of attention and emotional systems using sound stimuli. So I would present you with a series of tones, and occasionally I would present a very funny, odd tone, and that tone would elicit an orienting response or a novelty response in your brain. And it turns out that psychopaths have kind of an exaggerated novelty response. They're very appetitive. They seek out novelty in both, you know, willingness to engage in a wide variety of different substance-related things, to abuse, to using and, you know, changing jobs. So they really are novelty seekers, if you will. And it turns out their brain responds, you know, hyperactive to those novel stimuli. And then we also found that their brain is abnormal in responding to some other types of stimuli. All totaled, what those things, the kind of summary of those EEG studies was that it turns out that the brain systems that are engaged in those are part of what's called the medial temporal lobe, that is the areas just inside the ears, and that's a very important areas for emotional processing, and that those areas are disturbed in individuals with psychopathy. That is, they look like actually patients who have damage to those areas, even though there was no physical damage in these individuals. It definitely suggested that those circuits of the brain were implemented for the first time in the condition.
So then you wanted to do some fMRI scans. What did you hope those scans might show you that you couldn't get with the EEG?
So fMRI stands for functional magnetic resonance imaging, and it's essentially a measure of how blood flow changes in the brain. So I put you in an MRI scanner, I turn the system on, and I start recording where your blood is at any specific point in time. And so if you just move your fingers, for example, you know, and closing your fists back and forth, that will engage the neurons that control that motor behavior. And it turns out when neurons are engaged, they ask the blood to bring more oxygen, and we can measure where that oxygen goes in the brain. Of course, we can do this now all over the entire brain for any type of stimuli. So I can put you in the MRI scanner and measure where your brain is thinking for those emotional words, those neutral words, moral pictures, non-moral pictures, all these different areas. And it gives us very precise information about where in the brain we might be seeing things that are different. And so that functional MRI technique was really discovered in the early 90s, and we did the first studies with the functional MRI technique in psychopaths in Canada at the University of British Columbia when they would transport them from the maximum security prison in Abbotsford out to Vancouver for us, and we would scan them on the University Hospital, and then they would transport them back. And we scanned about 50 inmates that way over about 4 years. While I was in graduate school there at the University of British Columbia. And those were the first ever studies of using this functional MRI technique to study psychopathy. And the results basically echoed what we were finding with the EEG studies. That is, those medial temporal lobe structures, that what's called the amygdala. It's a tiny little amplifier in the brain. It kind of helps you recognize fearful faces, recognize environmentally important stimuli. That was abnormal in psychopaths. It wasn't functioning the same as we see in non-psychopathic inmates. And so that was some of the circuits that we were first showed were abnormal in individuals with psychopathy.
So it sounds like psychopathy represents some kind of damage or, I don't have the right words, but something isn't quite right with the emotional areas of the brain or the areas of the brain that are in part used for emotional purposes, correct?
Correct. No, absolutely correct. And so we refer to those areas collectively as a limbic system. Limbic stands for, you know, it's an emotional circuit of the brain. It's one of the older evolutionarily, you know, first to develop parts of the brain. And we have shown now routinely that those areas of the brain in psychopaths are not responding as normal. So they don't show the normal brain engagement during a wide variety of different types of stimuli, whether it's attention stimuli or emotional stimuli or moral stimuli. It just doesn't, you know, come to pass. And it turns out that what might be underlying that is a reduction in gray matter. So just like your muscle can be measured for density, and men with real strong dense muscles can lift more than an individual, a male, who has less dense muscles, the brain can be measured the same way. So we can quantify the gray matter, the thinking areas of the brain, with a special MRI technique that measures density. And when we applied that technique to study psychopathy, we found that psychopaths have less gray matter, less density, in almost the entire limbic system. And it's about 5-6% reduction relative to other inmates, and that's it's a significant effect. And what we believe it does is contributes to the poor functioning of that system, which then contributes to the symptoms of psychopathy, the lack of empathy that you see, etc. And so it really does appear that they have a weaker muscle in those areas of the brain, if you will, that help to control and regulate emotions and engender, you know, affective emotions in individuals. So their brains are definitely different.
It's really interesting because your book talks a lot about this inability to understand emotion. And to some extent, it feels like some of them even have an inability to feel some of these emotions in a meaningful way. But also, there's a lack of ability to interpret and understand metaphors and some words. You mentioned justice. I'm assuming love falls in there, that we all kind of intuitively understand.
It's true. I mean, I really do equate it to a lack of an ability. I mean, it's almost like if I threw up in front of you some sort of an Aztec symbols, you would be looking at like, I don't know what that is. And you'd have that blank kind of feeling. I have no idea what to do with that information. And psychopaths explain that that's how they feel when they're asked to do something emotional. So to try to say, you know, when you look at this picture, you know, do you feel empathy for the victim in that picture? I can give you another example. So there's these classic philosophical dilemmas, we call them moral dilemmas, that are presented. And so one of them is, you know, you're standing next to a train track, and a trolley is coming down the train track, and it's out of control, and it's going to hit five workers if you don't do anything. But you notice that there's a thing you can push, a lever you can push, and if you push the lever, it's going to go down the track, another track, and there's only one worker down there. So you're going to save four lives because you're going to switch that track. And most people would say, I'd push the button. Versus then you say, well, now you're same situation, the trolley's coming down the tracks, but you see the five men down there, and they don't know it's coming, and it's going to hit them, that's a certainty, and kill them all. But now there's an individual that's standing on a little bridge that's over the railroad tracks, and you know that if you push him off the bridge, well, then he's going to fall down and die, but he'll stop the trolley, and the other four will be saved. Would you push him? And most people now say, no, I wouldn't push him. That's something different. Well, it turns out that studies have shown that the brain response that makes you worried about pushing the person off is engendered in the amygdala. That is, that little amplifier of the brain goes, I don't think I want to do this. And that, or it fires up and then makes you stop and think, I don't want to do this. Well, psychopaths don't have that response. And so what we find in them is when we show them these moral scenarios and these moral dilemmas, and we do a wide variety of different ways with them, they don't get that amygdala response, that kind of automatic response of like, I don't know if I should do this. And so then they look at you with a blank expression on their face. They didn't get that, you know, amygdala input, so to speak. And now they're like, well, I probably wouldn't do it because you'll think I'm mean or something, you know. And so they come up with these contrived kind of responses. And really what we think it is it's just that amygdala responsivity is not functioning normally in them. They never learned, you know, that was something they're supposed to be doing. And because they have a different brain, and now we're trying to figure out, well, how do you teach them and train them in the presence of having this different brain? It's almost like there's a brain injury, and so we're going to retrain you to do the things that you used to do following your brain injury. So that's the type of attack that we're trying to look at now, is to, you know, work with the systems that they have and try to get them to do and behave better and recognize that they don't have that emotional input.
This is Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm speaking to Dr. Kent Kiel, author of The Psychopath Whisperer, The Science of Those Without Conscience. So it sounds like from all of the brain scans you've done and all the research, there's a massive correlational relationship here for sure. Do we know anything about causation yet? Have we been able to make that causational link?
We don't have a perfect answer to that question. I think I can try to address it a couple of ways. The first is that, you know, when we found these effects of the reduced gray matter in the limbic system in adults with psychopathy, men, we asked, well, maybe would we see it in boys who have the traits, you know, maximum security incarcerated boys who have these same traits And we found that that's the case, that, that we find the same 5 to 6% reduction in gray matter in the boys with these traits, just like we find in the men. So it doesn't appear to be something like due to atrophy. So it's not like from not using the system. You could imagine that if you tie your arm to your chest and, you know, because you got a broken bone, that your bicep muscle might atrophy. So we were worried that the work that we saw in adults might be due to some sort of atrophy from just not using their emotional systems their whole lives. But then when you see it in kids as early as age 12, 13, 14, that's likely not going to be due to, the most plausible interpretation is not that it's atrophy. So that would suggest then it's more likely developmental and or genetic, which then would suggest it might be causal. Now, what we also have is we have a large literature that says, well, you know, if I have a damage or I get lesion to those same circuits, I elicit psychopathic symptoms in those patients. Not necessarily the full manifestation of the disorder, but I elicit some of those symptoms. And so then, but what we don't know, in order to, I think, really complete the causal thinking here, is, well, we don't know if there's people out there who have the same brain that we see in psychopaths but don't act psychopathically. We don't have that answer. So we haven't studied everyone in the world, so we can't really figure out if it's 100% causal. But the next thing that might do is to say, well, if we take somebody who has a different brain and we give them a treatment that helps improve that those areas that are weaker, well, then that would then be, and they get better, or they don't act, you know, badly, or they develop better relationships, they keep their jobs longer, they have better outcomes. Maybe if we develop those systems, then that might be a way to kind of argue that there's a causal relationship between brain and behavior, because you can fix the behavior by fixing the brain. That's what we're studying right now.
So in the book, you also delve into trying to identify, to some extent, psychopathic traits in children or teenagers. And this seems to be fraught with a lot of difficulties that you don't have when you're dealing with adults.
Studying psychopathy always raises very important ethical, you know, considerations, and there's definitely, you really need to be engaged in those discussions. But when you work younger and younger, as you move down from, you know, 25-year-old offender to a 16-year-old first-time juvenile offender down to, you know, I have colleagues who are working with kids as early as age 3, 4, 5, you really do not want to label them with any psychiatric label that might be, you know, that might be prejudicial or, you know, even a self-fulfilling prophecy. You really have to be very careful how you're when you work with those individuals. So when we study the DSM, or the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association, that helps to articulate the different conditions and symptoms that we're going to study, you know, or do research with, they use different terms. And so we don't call kids, you know, psychopathic. They refer to them as conduct disordered, and in particular, conduct disordered with limited prosocial emotions is the newest specifier. But what they're really talking about are those callous and unemotional traits, those lack of empathy, guilt, and remorse, the recognition that those traits are very important to assess because they're very predictive of, you know, poor relationships, poor schooling outcomes, poor employment outcomes, and unfortunately sometimes serious antisocial behavior that ends up, you know, leading to prison. So let's try to figure out how to assess them, how to study them, and how to treat them. And there is a growing recognition that these traits are very important. But they have to be differentiated from other traits that are might also be important but aren't the same. And so there's a lot of work that's going on trying to make sure they're assessing, you know, those traits and then really studying the malleability of those traits. How do we steer people away from, you know, kids away from this trajectory? And the way we've been doing it for years is very ineffective. I mean, when I lived in British Columbia in 2000, so from 1994 to 2000, there was a 100% reconviction rate in the boys who went through the juvenile treatment programs there as adults within 5 years. So that was astonishing. 100% of the boys who were in a maximum security juvenile facility then were released. Within 5 years, they were in an adult facility. And that's 100% failure. And you know, that is a complete and utter inability to change the trajectory of any of those kids so that they didn't continue along that risk factor. And that's what we find to across the world, is that when you get into maximum security, and I'm not talking about, you know, a night in juvenile detention, I'm talking about a year or two sentence in juvenile for serious antisocial behavior, the highest risk kids, there's not a lot of programs that are good about changing that trajectory. And so that's one of the things that we're studying, is we actually work with a couple of programs now that are really doing the very best they can to try to see if they can change those trajectories. And then if they are changing those trajectories of kids out of antisocial behavior, then is that changing their brains? And that's what we really want to know, is can you heal the systems that we have identified now that are impaired?
I do want to talk more about treatment, because identifying physical defects or physical causes for psychopathy makes me think that treating this must be really difficult.
So the answer is yes. You know, for many years, clinicians used to just give up. I mean, in the psychodynamic era of psychology, where you were supposed to reflect and, talk to a therapist, the narcissism, the egocentric traits of psychopathy just made them, enjoy the treatment, but they never got better. So there's been a long-held kind of belief in the field, the dogma, if you will, that psychopaths are untreatable. And there's even been a few studies that have shown certain types of treatments, well-intentioned originally, didn't work out. In fact, some treatments might actually make psychopaths more likely to reoffend than if you didn't treat them at all. And so what's happened is that in a couple of different places around the world, some people got together and they said, well, let's see if we can kind of completely flip the treatment models on their head, and let's try to start with something completely fresh. And when they did that, and the one, my favorite example, is a place in Wisconsin, and they developed a juvenile treatment program, state-mandated program for highest-risk kids, kids that can't be addressed or treated in any other state facility because they keep getting in fights and they keep getting sent to solitary, et cetera. And they send these kids to this special treatment program. And this treatment program is a year long at least. It takes, it uses what's called contingency management programming, or it basically rewards positive behaviors, and it has small graduated punishments for negative behaviors. But the real focus is to reward the positive, behaviors, or positive reinforcement. And what happens is you turn out that when you have a youth who doesn't respond to punishment, and that's sometimes hard for people to understand because most of us respond to punishment, but some people don't. And when you have a kid that doesn't respond to punishment, but you can get him to respond to small rewards, a candy bar, a video games in their cells, movie privileges, other types of things, and they start to stop acting out and fighting and other things, you can start to get better thinking patterns in them, and you can start to change the way they think, and you can move them to start thinking about how to be in their own best interest. And this type of treatment, this was called cognitive behavioral treatment, with this positive reinforcement schedule, appears to be showing some improvements in the outcomes. And so, in particular, this program has shown that, in the 100-plus boys that have gone through the program, they were 50% less likely to reoffend violently than the boys in the system as normal. And so that's dramatic, first effect. I mean, to be able to show that in this super high-risk sample, you can reduce those poor outcomes by 50%, that's progress. And we're really excited about that. In particular, I'm very excited about it because it's the really first true evidence that I'm aware of that has shown that you can take a child who's on the highest risk trajectory for ending up in prison the rest of their life and maybe having a diagnosis of psychopathy when they get to adulthood, and changing it so that they don't end up that way. Now, it didn't work for everyone. Still 25% of the boys came back who went through treatment for doing something bad again in the future. But that's a big change from 75% of them or 100% of them. And so what we want to do now is study that treatment program, try to find out how we can make it even better so that we can get it down to, so zero, so none of them come back. And then eventually you might decide to move that type of a program into a detention center or maybe even to an after-school program so that you never end up get the kids into the adult or the juvenile correctional system generally. They do some detention time and then they end up finding ways to keep them from ever escalating into more bad things. So that's the real goal, is to try to study the brains of these youth and then adults and figure out how to develop and create better treatments for them.
So it sounds like the vast majority of treatment efforts right now are focused on young offenders and people who have already offended. Is there any work on preventative treatment, treating the kids who have these risk factors who maybe haven't committed any offenses yet?
Yes. There are a number of places around the country. There's a big group in Australia doing some of pioneering work here. There's a group in New Orleans in the United States doing similar work. And then a variety of other groups, and there probably are many that I'm even unaware of, where they are trying to take kids who have come in for some sort of behavioral problem. That is, they've gotten in a fight, in the schoolyard, or they've gotten into some sort of a, significant problems with their siblings or peers. And the recognition, the assessment of these traits very early then has led people to develop treatment programs to try to help them have better relationships, focus more on not using punishment, but using these other reward strategies, and that hopefully is going to show some success in terms of, you know, reducing the behavioral problems and reducing the, you know, the numbers of kids that end up going into the criminal justice system. So yes, there are a smatter of different individuals or different groups out there working with such kids, you know, with the ultimate goal of steering them off ever going into the juvenile correctional system. And so that work is ongoing and is exciting. And but mostly my own work has really focused on those that have definitely done something seriously wrong and ended up in a maximum security facility, because those are the hardest to work with. Those are the hardest to treat. And those are the ones that I'm focused on trying to help.
I'm curious, have there been any successful treatments of adults, people who you work with, high security inmates? Have there been any success stories in treatment there?
So unfortunately, these programs that I mentioned earlier have not generally been applied in any significant effort, I think, with adult populations. And so we don't know if the juvenile programs, the programs that it's working with juveniles, would work with adults. I have a lot of hope that they would, but I don't know of any large-scale implementation or studies to try to do that as of yet. But that doesn't mean that I am aware of a few case studies, one actually, you know, from Canada, where individuals who committed very bad crimes were released after 20 years in prison to the supervisory care of a psychiatrist who was both medicating them to reduce their, you know, bad impulses, but also structured, you know, ankle bracelet monitoring programming, you know, so they were basically leaving the halfway house in the morning, going to work, coming home, you know, and having dinner and everything there. And so they were very carefully monitored, but they were out in the community earning, you know, working a job and not in prison, and they'd been out for now, you know, 10 years at this point without reoffending as older adults. And so that, to me, is significant progress that probably would never happen in the United States. That those two cases I'm referring to, they had killed someone and committed a sexual assault as well at the same time, and they were released. In Canada, the laws, sentencing laws, are much less stringent than they do in the United States. Sometimes such a crime here would get hundreds of years of in prison, if that's possible, but that's what would happen here, much more punitive. Whereas in Canada, the sentencing laws, since they're different, and the philosophies, I think, are generally different, there was a more open-mindedness about releasing them onto, you know, into that type of a treatment program. And I mean, there's definitely people on both sides of the fence about that, but I think that if you wanted to ask about progress, that's progress. That's someone being able to recover, not reoffend, earn a living, saves tax dollars, saves incarceration costs, and so that is progress. But it also resonates with me that's difficult for victims, you know, that someone might be released after having done something like that. So there's lots of very complicated scenarios, but I mean, when you can see something like that, that holds out hope for me that we can really steer these young kids or first-time offenders away from such behavior.
You're listening to Science for the People with Rochelle Saunders. We're discussing the use of neuroimaging and social science research to understand the causes and effects of psychopathy. We'll be back after the break with more of my conversation with Kent Keel, author of The Psychopath Whisperer. Stay tuned.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm joined this week by Dr. Kent Keel, one of the world's leading authorities on the science of psychopathy and the author of The Psychopath Whisperer, The Science of Those Without Conscience. Have we had a chance to analyze the brains or rescan people who are known psychopaths, have gone through some kind of treatment? And I'm thinking as well of maybe some of the younger people who went through the system you mentioned before. Have we looked to see in their brains if something physically has changed?
We're doing that right now.
Mm,
so we are studying the boys as they go through treatment. to try to understand how their brains do change, and if there are, if we do find brain change, is that what is predicting not coming back to prison? And so we do know that certain treatments will change the way the brain functions. We do know that certain forms of cognitive-based treatments or learning new things will change the structure of the brain, and we can measure those changes now with the MRI techniques that we can deploy and use in these settings. And so we are very encouraged that what we might be able to see is that these treatment programs do change the brain for the better, help to make it essentially more normal, and then that amount of change is predictive of not coming back to prison again. And so that's what we're hoping to be able to demonstrate and show. And then maybe identify that, you know, maybe some kids only need 5 months of treatment and they show the same brain change, but other kids may need, 2 years or 3 years of treatment before they see the same amount of change. And that just might be due to individual differences and a variety of different reasons, but that's what we're really hoping to be able to reinform so that that might help get that reduction in violent crime from, down to zero so that we don't see anybody coming back.
Most of the research in this area seems to really be focused on male offenders, both men and boys. You mentioned in your book that there's not a lot of research on female psychopaths. Why is that?
There hasn't been nearly as much. It's partially, I think, because there's 10 times as many psychopaths who are male than are female, according to the epidemiology literature. We have started, and we've shown that in girls, maximum security incarcerated girls who have these high callous and emotional traits, that they show the same brain differences as we see in the boys from the same facility. So not as big of a sample, 30 girls versus 200 boys, but we found the same effects. And we are now studying women using the imaging techniques, for the first time. So we've scanned about 300 women from minimum up to maximum security, and we are examining, how their brains is it similar or different from what we see in the men. And right now we're actively in the middle of doing that. So there is some research efforts to look at women with psychopathy, but there's not a lot of papers that have been published yet, and no papers really on brain imaging findings. But certainly some studies suggest that the traits do predict recidivism in women as it does in men. One study didn't find that same effect. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to study and apply this construct to female samples.
It certainly seems like, just in general, there are way fewer female psychopaths than there are male psychopaths. Do we know why?
We don't know exactly why. My guess would be that the brain is completely different in females than males. So we and others have some amazing data showing just how different the brains of women are versus men. So men have, different limbic structures than do women. Women actually have a lot more gray matter in that orbital frontal cortex and in other areas that are very important for, emotional regulation development. Women are usually way more empathic than men on average. And so it appears that, frankly, women are genetically endowed through the XX chromosome versus the XY at being less psychopathic than men because they have essentially a better brain when it comes to this disorder in particular. So that's pretty interesting, the gender differences that we've seen. We've been really fascinated by how robust the differences are in terms of brain gray matter distributions between men and women, and then how that might relate to antisocial behavior and or other types of important issues like leadership and et cetera. So I definitely, having grown up with four sisters, I think that women should rule the world. But it's definitely been interesting from a neuroscience perspective to try to, again, poke at or understand the relationship between brain structure, for example, and then behavior and how it predicts. And so that's something that we're working on right now as well.
Do we know if that difference in gray matter is to do with genetics, or is it maybe something that happens from a social impetus?
I'm pretty certain it's going to be a genetic difference. The areas that we're seeing are very robustly different. And there are some variants, of course, between women and between men in the, how masculine how male you are or how female you are, and there's certainly some ranges there. But I'm pretty sure the effects that we're seeing in the brain data are going to be mostly from genetics.
So the neuroscience work in this field is really leading us toward the idea that psychopaths have what some might call a physical disability, which causes them to be more likely to commit crime. And I can't imagine your research not having repercussions in the court system. So what has your work's impact in the legal system been so far?
Yeah, there's been a lot of research recently trying to understand, you know, how neuroscience will implicate, you know, everything from sentencing decisions through culpability questions through, you know, in the United States where there are death penalties, states that have the death penalty mitigation questions. Generally, what the work has shown is that understanding the neuroscience, understanding the genetics usually leads to more rehabilitative types of functions rather than retributivist types of things. That is, you don't necessarily blame somebody or hold them as blameworthy if they happen to have some sort of a brain abnormality, if we want to call it that. And so there is a lot of work that's happening at those two intersections and challenges kind of people's thinking about free will, thinking about choice. How informed is your free will or choices? And so there is a lot of academic debate, but then it really does actually get into the courtroom. So we are actually seeing, you know, cases, you know, where neuroscience is being used routinely to help understand somebody's mental or behavioral health and whether or not that should be potentially relevant to, should you sentence them to longer prison, less prison, treatment facilities, forced medication for their brain problems versus not. And so there are a myriad of different issues that, you know, the science, you know, when lawyers bring it into the courtroom, it raises a number of different, you know, and very important issues. It is there to stay, if you will. It is in the courtroom, and neuroscience is only going to continue to expand its role in the legal arena for helping to make determinations about, you know, if your brain's damaged, do we hold you as responsible? You know, what happens, you know, civil stuff too, you know, litigation for brain injury and car accidents, all sorts of different types of things. The analysis and the things that we can do with the MRI scans are so sophisticated that if there is a brain abnormality associated with some event, be it like a car accident or whatever, or we'll find it. I mean, we can find it now. And so the legal system then has to decide how to use that information, and it goes from there. But we actually have a whole consulting group that we try to help lawyers be educated about these things so that they're doing the best science, not saying too much or saying that what the science doesn't support. But we do a lot of active consulting and education with lawyers and judges now.
It seems, I mean, as a layperson, a moral and legal minefield to walk into, because on the one hand, we're talking about people who it appears have legitimate mental disabilities that they can't necessarily control, certainly if they didn't know they had them. But on the other hand, we're talking about a population that is incredibly unsympathetic and as a whole has done some fairly horrible things. So to some extent, I can see the complications here.
No, I mean, absolutely. And then I guess, you know, just to be, my own perspective has been that, you know, when somebody commits a terrible crime, you know, society has to be protected. They're going to be incarcerated or incapacitated either in a correctional facility or in a psychiatric facility, you know, for treatment. And that's just, I think, a foregone conclusion. But wouldn't it be nice if we would have been able to prevent some of those things from happening? And so by doing this research and by studying, you know, individuals before they commit those types of crimes, that's the real goal. Because, you know, one of the facts about that treatment program in Wisconsin that I've been discussing is that the kids that didn't get treatment, you know, the kids in the system as normal, of the 150 kids, they killed 16 people in the 2 years following release from prison. So 16 people lost their life. But the boys that went through the treatment program, even though 25% committed a new violent crime, they didn't kill a single person. And so not only do they have a 50% reduction in violent, you know, recidivism, but they have a 100% reduction in actually, you know, the worst possible outcomes, which is a homicide. And so there just isn't anything better than that program, frankly. I mean, it is just the most amazing thing that I've ever come across in my career. And helping people to duplicate it, replicate it. The state of Georgia is currently replicating that. And so it's just an amazing opportunity to try to see change occur within your lifetime for the better. And if more and more places were to adopt such programming and to continue to study it and make it better, then I think we'll all be in a safer place.
It does also seem to me that there's some very careful ethical considerations when dealing with screening children, or, and I'm thinking young children for this kind of thing. If it's a physical, if it's something physical in the brain that shows up, you know, in a 2 or 3 year old, then it seems to be both an idea of prevention where you can maybe get them into a treatment early to start preventing some of what may happen if they're high risk. But at the same time, like you said before, we don't want to label these young kids as psychopaths early in life and then kind of send them just from the label down the wrong track. So that also seems like an area where we need to be really careful where we go.
Right. And there's a lot of people that are working, you know, on that exact area to try to make sure there's not that pejorative label attached to somebody where there's no, especially because there's no good scientific evidence that you could study someone from when they were 2 and predict that they're going to end up where they're going to be as an adult. And so, there's lots of different childhood, you know, problems and disorders that, parents just want the right answers. And so they can try to get their kids in the best programming or schools or aftercare settings to try to prevent them from ever, you know, going down this path. And so I have many, many emails from parents who have said that, you know, their kids were misdiagnosed with, you know, ADHD, and then they were misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder, and then they were misdiagnosed with, you know, some other ailment. But what they really had is an affective problem. They weren't, you know, appreciating, and they didn't show, they were not responding to any types of punishments or sanctions. And so the idea of using this positive reinforcement strategies and other types of things to help shape their behavior, you don't have to call the kid a psychopath, but you can say that you just don't respond to punishment, so we're going to try something different. And one of the funny stories that I try to liken this to is to get people to think about it is that I used to do research with killer whales. And I would never think about spanking a killer whale to try to get it to do what I want. It's just hilarious to try to think about doing that, right? You're going to get your leg bit off. And so what you do instead is you work with positive reinforcement strategies. You feed them when they do what you've asked, and you give them an extra bonus or a toy or something. And so that type of molding, that type of shaping of behavior works very well in that environment. And it just turns out that it works very well for kids who, the small proportion of kids who won't respond to punishment. And so that's the type of shaping, that's the type of, you know, ways that psychologists can help contribute to changing people's behavior for the better. And it's in everyone's best interest, but most importantly, the kids' best interest. Because if they don't come back to crime, then they're going to have a much happier life, or back to prison. So that's I think the main kind of central things that we've been able to learn with the science. And also I would say that even if you find that there's a brain difference or a brain abnormality, that doesn't mean it's not malleable. You know, we continually change the dogma in neuroscience is that, you know, once you reach 25, your brain stops growing or whatever. That's so not true. We now know that the brain continues to change throughout your life, and that it might be harder to change as you get really much older or as you age, but we certainly know that, you know, we can change the way the brain looks, functions, et cetera. That's called neuroplasticity. And there's a lot of hope that we can continue to improve the functions of individuals with these problems.
Kent, thanks so much for joining me today. It's a fascinating book and a really fascinating field.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And if you want to learn more about Dr. Keel and his work, you can go to www.kentkeel.com or www.psychopathwhisperer.com to get more information about his research and the book. You'll also find links to Kent Keel and The Psychopath Whisperer on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. Just before signing off today, we wanted to give a shout out to a couple of important events happening in British Columbia in the next couple of weeks. If you're a regular listener to the show, you'll have heard us talk about and with the group Evidence for Democracy before. They're a Canadian nonpartisan and not-for-profit organization advocating for the transparent use of science and evidence in public policy and government decision-making. They formed out of concerns over the ongoing Canadian government cuts to important science institutions and policies that restrict the flow of scientific information to the public. Evidence for Democracy has partnered with the Vancouver Skeptics in Vancouver and the Center for Inquiry in Kelowna to host screenings of the CBC documentary Silence of the Labs. This documentary investigates federal funding cuts to key research monitoring programs, and it covers important issues at the intersection of science and policy, an intersection we spend a lot of time thinking about here at Science for the People. The Vancouver screening of Silence of the Lambs will be held at the Railway Club in Vancouver on Sunday, November 23rd at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Entry is free. All you need to do is say you're with the Vancouver Skeptics at the door, and you're in. The screening in Kelowna is being held at the Rotary Center for the Arts Boardroom on Friday, November 28th at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. We here at Science for the People think this is an important issue and an important documentary. So if you're in either the Vancouver area or the Kelowna area, do consider coming by to watch the screening. You can grab more specifics about the screening location and times at the Evidence for Democracy website at evidencefordemocracy.ca. Or, if you're a hardcore keener, you can volunteer to help organize a screening in your community yourself. We've linked to Evidence for Democracy on our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. And while you're there, click the links to connect with us on iTunes, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and subscribe to the weekly podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.